Chapter 7 Memories. Perfect happiness is the soul's acceptance of what is, without question or objection. And this is what I felt through all my being on that never-to-be-forgotten night. A tree may delight in the soft wind blowing through its leaves. A daisy in the meadow grass may rejoice in the warmth of the sun and open to it its golden heart without bothering to analyze the reason for its sense of ecstasy. Even so, I was the recipient of light and of an exquisite felicity for which I needed and desired no explanation. It was enough for me simply to be. I realized, of course, that with the Harlans and with their two paid attendants, the materialistic Dr. Braille and the secretarial machine Mr. Swinton, Rafael Santoris could have nothing in common. And as I had learned from daily experience that even the most trifling event in our lives never happens without some cause, however hidden, I was sure that the reason for his having touched our lives must exist somehow in connection with myself. As I say, however, I did not give the matter much thought. I was satisfied to breathe the invigorating serenity on which my spirit floated with soaring wings. I slept like a child after enjoying much play and pleasure. I woke like a child to whom everything seems brim full with new beauty. That the day was sunny seemed right and natural. No cloud could have obscured the bright atmosphere in which I moved and lived. It was, of course, an atmosphere of my own creating, and therefore would not be disturbed by any storm, unless I chose to let the storm affect me. It is possible for every human being to live in the sunlight of the soul, whatever his material surroundings may be. The so-called practical person may have said to me, "Why are you so happy? I see no real cause for you to be so. You have met someone with whom you feel a sympathy of tastes, ideas, and sentiments. But on the other hand, you are surrounded by self-styled realists who consider him mad or self-serving. Wouldn't it be better at least to weigh their opinions in the balance? It seems to me this is a time for caution." Indeed, the bright wave of joy into which I had so heedlessly plunged might, had I given the matter careful consideration, have flung me bruised and broken on a desolate shore for the remainder of my life. It was almost as though, like a callow teenager, I had fallen in love at first sight. To my mind, however, there is no such thing as falling in love at first sight, not if it is true love. The very expression falling in love conveys a false idea. What the world generally calls love is not love at all. Indeed, why the word falling? If love is true, ought it not to be arising? Moreover, in my heart and mind, there was nothing regarding Rafael Santoris beyond a keen interest and a sense of true friendship. I was sure that his beliefs were the same as mine, and that he had been working along the same lines which I had been following, just as two musicians, inspired by a mutual love of their art, may enjoy playing their instruments together. Even so, I felt that he and I had met on a plane of thought where we had both been wandering for a long time, separately. The dream yacht, with its white sails spread out ready for a cruise, was as beautiful by day, standing there in the sunshine under a blue sky, as by night, with its electric radiance flashing against the stars, and I was eager to be on board. We were delayed, however, by an attack of nerves on Catherine's part. She, the next morning, was seized by a violent fit of hysteria and gave way to it completely, sobbing, laughing, and gasping for breath in a manner which made her seem quite unhinged. It swept away all her self-control. Dr. Braille at once took her in charge, while Mr. Harlan fumed and fretted as he paced angrily up and down the deck with brooding eyes. He looked at me where I stood, calmly waiting and dressed for the excursion of the day.
"I'm sorry for all this delay," he said. "Catherine gets worse every day. Her nerves are tearing her to pieces."
"She allows them to do so," I replied. "And Dr. Braille allows her to give vent to her feelings." He shrugged.
"You don't like Braille, that's clear," was his comment. "But he's clever, and he does his best."
"To keep his patience," I suggested with a smile. He turned on his heel and faced me.
"Oh, come now," he said. "Could you cure her?"
"I could have cured her in the beginning," I replied. "But it is too late now. Now no one can cure her but herself." He paced up and down again.
"She won't be able to go with us to visit Santoris," he said. "Of that I am sure."
"Shall we put it off?" I suggested. His eyebrows went up and he looked at me in surprise.
"Why, no, certainly not. It will be a change for you and a pleasure of which I would not deprive either of us. Catherine, however..."
At this juncture, Dr. Braille entered the saloon with soft steps, wearing his most professional manner.
"Miss Harlan is better now," he announced. "She will be quite calm in a few minutes. But it is important that she remain quiet. It would not be safe for her to attempt any excursion today."
"Will that not need prevent the rest of us from going?" said Mr. Harlan.
"Oh, no, certainly not. In fact, Miss Harlan says she hoped you would go, and ask you to make your excuses to Mr. Santoris. I shall, of course, be in attendance on her."
"You won't come, then?"
An unconscious look of relief brightened Mr. Harlan's features.
"And as Swinton's duties will prevent him from joining us, we shall be a party of only three. Captain Derrick, myself, and our little friend here."
Turning to me, he said briskly,
"We may as well be off, then. Is the boat ready?"
We were informed at that point that Mr. Santoris had sent his own boat and men to fetch us, and that they had been waiting for some minutes. Thus, we prepared to go at once. While Mr. Harlan was getting his overcoat and searching for his field glasses, Dr. Braille spoke to me in a low tone.
"The truth of the matter is, Miss Harlan has been greatly upset by the visit of Mr. Santoris and by some of the things he said last night. She could not sleep afterward, and her mind was agitated by the most distressing thoughts. I am very glad she has decided not to see him again today."
"Do you consider his influence harmful?" I asked him, slightly amused.
"As I remarked last night," the doctor replied, "I consider him not quite sane. A highly nervous person like Miss Harlan would be best without the company of such clever but wholly irresponsible theorists."
The color burned in my cheeks. "You include me in that category, of course," I remarked. "For I said last night that if Mr. Santoris was mad, then so am I. My views are the same as his." He smiled in a superior way.
"Oh, there is no harm in you," he replied condescendingly. "You may think what you like. You are a woman, clever, charming, and full of delightful fancies, but weighed down by the restrictions of your sex. I mean no offense, I assure you. It is only that a woman's views, whatever they may be, are never accepted by those of rational mind."
I laughed gaily, for I had already taken his measure.
"I see," I retorted. "And rational beings must always be men?" "In the fact that men ordain the world's governing and progress, you have your answer," was his reply.
"And only by analysis is sound understanding possible," I laughed again, just as gaily. Then I added more seriously, "The world is losing its equilibrium owing to that attitude. Be careful, Dr. Braille, that you don't analyze yourself into the very madness you condemn in others. Moreover," I added severely, "you should know that what we condemn in others is a clue to the faults we contain in ourselves. You suggested Mr. Santoris was a charlatan." I left the thought dangling there. Dr. Braille seemed on the point of exploding with anger when Mr. Harlan called to me. I hastened to join him and Captain Derrick. The boat awaiting us was manned by four sailors in white jerseys, rimmed with scarlet, bearing the name of the yacht to which they belonged, the Dream. The men were dark-skinned and dark-eyed. We took them at first for Portuguese or Malays, but they turned out to be from Egypt. They saluted us without speaking, and as soon as we were seated, we pulled swiftly away over the water. Captain Derek watched their movements with considerable respect.
"Plenty of grit in those chaps," he commented aside to Mr. Harlan. "Look at their muscular arms. I suppose they don't speak a word of English."
Mr. Harlan thereupon tried one of them with a remark about the weather. The man smiled, and the sudden gleam of his white teeth gave a wonderful light and charm to his naturally grave cast of countenance.
"Beautiful day," he said. "Very happy sky."
The expression, "happy sky," attracted me. It recalled to my mind a phrase I had once read in the translation of an inscription found in an Egyptian sarcophagus. "The peace of the morning befriend thee, and the light of the sunset, and the happiness of the sky." The words rang in my ears with an odd familiarity, like the verse of some poem loved and learned by heart in childhood. Very shortly we were alongside the Dream, and soon on board, where Rafael Santoris received us with kindly courtesy and a warm welcome. He expressed polite regret at the absence of Miss Harlan, none for that of Dr. Braille or Mr. Swinton, and then introduced us to his captain, an Italian named Mario Fazio, of whom Santoris said to us smilingly, "He is a scientist as well as a skipper, and he needs both science and skill in the management of such a vessel as this. He will take Captain Derek in charge and explain to him the mystery of our shining sails at night, and also the secret of our sailing without wind." Fazio saluted and gave a cheerful response. "Are you ready to start now?" he asked, speaking very good English, with just the slightest trace of a foreign accent.
"Perfectly."
Fazio lifted his hand with a sign to the man at the wheel. In a moment the yacht began to move, without the slightest noise. No grinding of ropes or rattling of chains, no creaking of boards. She swung round gracefully and began to glide through the water with a swiftness that was almost incredible. The sails billowed out, although there was not a stir of wind in the air, a condition in which any ordinary schooner would have been hopelessly becalmed. And almost before we knew it, we were out of Loch Scavaig and flying over the water, as though borne on the wings of some great white bird. We followed the wild and picturesque coast of Skye towards Loch Brockadale. One of the most remarkable features about the yacht was the extraordinary lightness with which she skimmed the waves. She seemed to ride above them rather than part them with her keel. Everything on board expressed the finest taste as well as the most perfect convenience. I saw Mr. Harlan gazing about him in utter astonishment at the elegance of his surroundings. Santoris showed us all over the vessel, talking to us with the ease of an old friend. "You know the familiar axiom," he said, "anything worth doing is worth doing well. The Dream was only a fancy in my brain until I set to work with Fazio to make it a reality. Owing to our discovery of the way to compel the waters to give us our motive power, we have no blackening smoke or steam, so that our furniture and fittings are preserved from dinginess and tarnish. It has therefore been possible to have the saloon delicately painted, as you see." Here he opened the door of the apartment mentioned, and we stepped into it as into a fairy palace. The saloon was much loftier than on the usual yacht. On all sides of it were windows, oval in shape, and set between the most exquisitely painted panels of sea pieces, apparently the work of some real artist. Overhead the ceiling was draped. Pale turquoise blue silk formed a canopy, which was gathered on four sides in rich folds. At the center of the ceiling, a crystal lamp hung in the shape of a star.
"You live like a king," remarked Mr. Harlan,
a trifle enviously.
"You know how to use your father's fortune."
"My father's fortune was made to be used," answered Santoris with perfect good humor, "and I think he is satisfied with the way I have spent it. But I have touched very little of it. I have made my own fortune."
"Indeed?" exclaimed Mr. Harlan. "How?"
He looked keenly interested. "Ah, that's asking too much of me," laughed Santoris.
You may be satisfied, however, that has not been through defrauding my neighbors. It is comparatively easy to gain wealth if you know how to coax a few of Mother Nature's secrets out of her, and if you are willing to share with others what you gain. Nature is very kind to those of her children who are kind to her. In fact, she spoils them, for the more they ask of her, the more she gives them. Besides, every man should make his own way, even if he inherits wealth. That is the only way to feel worthy of one's place in this beautiful, ever-busy world. He preceded us out of the saloon and showed us the staterooms. Of these there were five, daintily furnished in white and blue and white and rose. "These are for my guests whenever I have any," he said. "This stateroom is for a princess, if one should ever honor me with her presence." And he opened a door to the right of us, through which we saw a large, lovely room, gleaming with iridescent hues and sparkling with touches of gold and crystal. The bed was draped with cloudy lace, through which a shimmer of pale rose color made itself visible. The carpet was colored a dark moss green and formed a perfect setting for the quaintly shaped furniture, which was all of sandalwood inlaid with ivory. On a small table of carved ivory in the center of the room lay a bunch of Madonna lilies tied with a finely twisted cord of gold. We murmured our admiration, and Santoris addressed me directly for the first time since we had come on board. "Will you go in and rest a while till luncheon?" he said. "I place the lilies there for your acceptance." The color rushed to my cheeks, and I looked at him with a little wonderment. "But I am not a princess." His eyes smiled down into mine. "No? Then I must have dreamed you were." My heart gave a quick throb. Some memory touched my brain, though where the memory was I could not tell. Mr. Harlan glanced at me and laughed lightly. "Didn't I tell you the other day?" he asked. "Did I not call you the princess of a fairy tale? I was not far wrong." They left me to myself. As I stood alone in the beautiful room, thus placed at my disposal, a curious feeling came over me that these luxurious surroundings were, after all, not new to my experience. I had been accustomed to them for a great part of my life. Stay, how foolish! A great part of my life? What part of it indeed? I briefly reviewed my own career, a difficult and solitary childhood, hard and uphill work, which had become my lot as soon as I was old enough to work at all, incessant study, and certainly no surplus of riches. Where, then, had I known luxury? I sank into a chair, considering the matter dreamily. The floating scent of sandalwood and the perfume of lilies commingled to form an impression of a fragrant garden in some eastern land, long ago familiar to me. As I sat there musing, I suddenly became conscious of an inrush of power and a sense of dominance which seemed to lift me out of myself as though without warning. I had been given the full control of a great kingdom and its people. Catching sight of my own reflection in an opposite mirror, I was startled and almost frightened by the expression on my face, the proud light in my eyes, the haughty curve of a smile on my lips. "What am I thinking of?" I exclaimed almost aloud. "I am not myself today. Some remnant of a cast-off pride has awakened in me and made me less of the humble student. I reject this subtle suggestion. Surely it is only an evil influence, perhaps from the past, that assaults my mind. Can it be the influence of Santoris? No, I will never believe it." And yet, a vague uneasiness beset me, and I rose and paced restlessly. I then paused where the lovely Madonna lilies lay on the ivory table. Remembering that they had been placed there for me, I raised them gently and inhaled their delicious fragrance. As I did so, I saw lying immediately beneath them a golden cross of a mystic shape I knew well, its upper half forming a seven-pointed star also of gold. With joy I took it up and kissed it reverently. As I compared it with the one I always wore secretly on my own person, I knew that all would be well, and I need have no distrust of Rafael Santoris. No injurious effect on my mind could possibly be exerted by his influence. I was thrown back on myself then for a clue to that singular wave of hauteur, so entirely the opposite of my own disposition. I could not trace its source, but I speedily mastered it. Fastening one of the snowy lilies to my waistband, where it contrasted cheerfully to the bright bit of bell heather, which I cherish now more than any jewel, I went up on deck, where I found my host, Mr. Harland, Captain Derrick, and Mario Fazio, all talking animatedly together. "The mystery is cleared up," said Mr. Harland, addressing me as I approached. "Captain Derrick is satisfied. He has learned how one of the finest schooners he has ever seen can make full speed in any weather without wind."
"Oh, no, I haven't learned how to do it. I'm a long way from that," said Derrick good-humoredly. "But I've seen how it's done, and it's marvelous. If that invention could be applied to all ships."
"Ah, but first of all, it would be necessary to instruct the shipbuilders," put in Fazio. "They would have to learn their trade all over again. Our yacht looks as though she were built on the same lines as all yachts, but you know, you have seen, that she is entirely different."
Captain Derrick gave a nod of grave emphasis. Santoris, meantime, had come to my side. Our glances met. He saw that I had received and understood the message of the lilies, and a light and color came into his eyes that made them beautiful. "Men have not yet fully enjoyed their heritage," he said, taking up the conversation. "Our yacht's motive power seems complex, but in reality it is very simple. And the same force that propels this lightweight vessel would propel the biggest liner afloat. Nature has given us the materials for everything we'd like to do, physically and mentally. But because we do not listen to her, but seek rather to impose our will on her, we deny those gifts to be there. Nothing in the earth, water, or air exists that may not be pressed into service, if we would only listen. It is in the study of natural forces that true conquest exists." He smiled briefly. "It took us hundreds of years to discover merely the wonders of steam, and reflect how Fulton, its discoverer, was mocked until he set his first ship afloat. Yet his discovery was not really wonderful. Its potential was always there, waiting to be discovered. One might say the same of electricity. Though some people call it miraculous, it is no miracle, but a perfectly common and natural part of the world around us. We have only failed, until now, to learn how to apply it to our needs. And even though wider disclosures are being made by science every day, we still bar the acceptance of new revelations by our obstinacy, preferring to remain ignorant rather than open ourselves humbly to what is. A few grains in weight of hydrogen have power enough to raise 1,000,000 tons to a height of more than 300 feet. And if we could only find a way to liberate the forces contained even in lumpish matter, we might change man's whole way of life and make him less a menial laborer than a philosopher. The wildest fairy tales might come true, and Earth might be transformed into a paradise. And as for motive power, a thimble full of concentrated fuel might take the largest ship across the widest ocean. I say if we could only find a way. Some think they are finding some of those ways."
"You, for example?" suggested Mr. Harland with a laugh.
"Yes, I, for example, if you like. Will you come in now to luncheon?"
He led the way. Mr. Harland and I followed. Captain Derrick, who I saw held him rather in awe, had arranged to eat separately with Fazio and the other officers of the crew. In our own dining room, we were waited upon by dark-skinned men attired in the picturesque costume of the East, who performed their duties with noiseless and graceful efficiency. The yacht had slackened its speed for some time and appeared to be merely floating lazily on the surface of calm water. We were told she could always do this and make almost imperceptible headway, provided there was no impending storm. It seemed as if we were scarcely moving, and the whole atmosphere surrounding us expressed the most delicious tranquility. The luncheon prepared for us was of the daintiest and most elegant description, and Mr. Harland, who, on account of his ill health, seldom had a good appetite, ate now with the zest and good cheer I had never so far witnessed in him. He particularly appreciated the wine, a rich, ruby-colored beverage that was unlike anything I, for one, had ever tasted. "There is nothing remarkable about it," said Santoris when I questioned him as to its origin. "It is simply real wine, though you may say that such of itself is remarkable. Indeed, there is nothing like it in the market. This wine is the pure juice of grapes, prepared in such a manner as to nourish the blood without inflaming it. It is harmless, and in fact, Harland, for you, it is an excellent nourishment."
"Why for me in particular?" queried Harland with a smile.
"Because you need it," answered Santoris. "My dear fellow, you are not in the best of health, and you will never improve under your present treatment." I looked up eagerly.
"That is what I have thought too," I said, "only I dared not express it."
Mr. Harland surveyed me with amusement.
"Dared not? I know nothing that you would not dare. Even with all your boldness, however, you are full of theories, and theories never make anyone well."
Santoris exchanged a swift glance with me. Then he spoke. "Theory without practice is useless, of course," he said. "Surely, however, you can see that this lady has reached a plane of thought where she dwells in perfect health and contentment? And can she not serve you as an object lesson?"
"Not at all," replied Mr. Harland almost testily. "She is a woman whose life has been immersed in study and contemplation, and because she has allowed herself to forego many of the world's pleasures, she can be made happy by a mere nothing, a handful of roses, or the sound of sweet music."
"Are they nothing?" inquired Santoris.
"To a businessman, they are."
"And business itself? Is it not also, from certain points of view, a nothing?"
"Santoris, if you are going to be transcendental, I will have none of you," Mr. Harland exclaimed with a vexed laugh. "What I wish to say is simply that my little friend here, for whom I have a great esteem, let me assure you, is not really capable of forming an opinion of the condition of a man like myself, nor is she able to judge of the treatment likely to benefit me. She does not even know the nature of my illness. I can see, however, that she has taken a dislike to my physician, Dr. Braille."
"I never take dislikes, Mr. Harland," I interposed quickly. "I merely trust to a guiding instinct which tells me when a man is sincere and when he is not. That is all."
"Well, you've decided that Braille is insincere," he replied, "and you hardly think him clever. But if you would consider the point logically, you might inquire what motive could he possibly have for playing the humbug with me."
Santoris smiled. "Oh, man of business, you can ask that?" We were at the end of luncheon. The servants had retired, and Mr. Harland was sipping his coffee and smoking a cigar. "You can ask that?" Santoris repeated. "You, a millionaire, with one daughter who is your sole heiress?" Mr. Harland's sharp eyes flashed with sudden menace.
"If I thought,"
he began, then broke off. Presently he resumed.
"You are not aware of the true state of affairs, Santoris. Wizard and scientist as you are, you cannot know everything. I need constant medical attendance, and my disease is incurable."
"No," said Santoris quietly, "it is not incurable." A sudden hope illumined Harland's worn and haggard face.
"Not incurable? But my good fellow, you don't even know what it is."
"I do know. I also know how it began and when. I know how it has progressed and how it will end. I know, too, how it can be checked, cut off even now in its development, and utterly destroyed. But," he sat back in his chair, "the cure would depend on yourself more than on Dr. Braille or any other physician.
At present, no good is being done you, and much harm. For instance, you are in pain now.
I am, but how can you tell?
By the small, almost imperceptible lines on your face, which contract quite unconsciously to yourself. I can stop that dreary suffering at once for you, if you will allow me.
Oh, I will allow you, certainly.
Mr. Harlan smiled incredulously.
But I think you overestimate your abilities.
I have never been a boaster, replied Santoris seriously. But if you will try this, you shall keep whatever opinion of me you wish. So saying, he drew from his pocket a tiny crystal vial set in a sheath of gold. 2 drops of this liquid in your wine glass will make you feel a new man. We watched with strained attention as he carefully allowed 2 small drops of liquid, bright and clear as dew, to fall one after the other into Mr. Harlan's glass. Now, drink without fear, and say goodbye to pain for at least 48 hours. With a docility quite unusual to him, Mr. Harlan obeyed.
May I go on smoking? He asked.
You may. A minute passed, and Mr. Harlan's face expressed sudden surprise and relief. Well, what now? Asked Santoris. How is the pain?
It's gone, was the answer. I can hardly believe it. Still, I'm bound to admit it.
I'm glad, and it will not come back. Not today, at any rate, nor tomorrow. Shall we go out on the deck now? We assented. And as we left the saloon, he said casually, You must see the glow of the sunset over Loch Coruisk. It's always a fine sight, and this evening it promises to be especially fine. Look at the many picturesque clouds floating about. We are turning back now to Loch Scavaig, and when we get there, we can land and do the rest of the excursion on foot. It's not much of a climb. Will you feel equal to it? This question he put to me personally. I smiled. Of course, I feel equal to anything. Besides, I've been too lazy on board the Diana and have taken no real exercise. A walk will do me good. Mr. Harlan seated himself in one of the long reclining chairs, which were placed under an awning on deck invitingly. His eyes were clearer and his face more composed than I had ever seen it.
Those drops you gave me are magical, Santoris, he said. I wish you'd let me have a supply.
Santoris stood looking at him kindly. It would not be safe for you, he said. The remedy is a sovereign one, if used rarely and with extreme caution. In uninstructed hands, however, it is dangerous. Its work is to stimulate certain cells. At the same time, like everything taken to excess, it can destroy. Moreover, here he turned away before adding, it would not agree with Dr. Braille's medicines.
You really think Braille is an imposter?
Imposter is too strong a word. No, I will give him credit for believing in his skill up to a point. But of course he knows that that so-called electric treatment he is giving your daughter is perfectly worthless, just as he knows she is not really ill.
Not really ill?
Mr. Harlan almost bounced up from the chair, while I felt a secret thrill of satisfaction.
Why, she's been a miserable, querulous invalid for years.
Since she broke off her engagement to a worthless rascal, said Santoris calmly. You see, I know all about it. I listened in astonishment. How could he know the intimate details of a life like Catherine's, which would scarcely interest a man like him? Your daughter's trouble is written on her face, he continued. Warped affections, slain desires, disappointed hopes, and neither the strength nor the will to turn those troubles into blessings. Her memories resemble an army of malarious germs, eating away her moral fiber. Braille knows that what she needs is the belief that someone has an interest not only in her, but in the particularly morbid view she has taught herself to take of life. He is actively showing that interest. The rest is easy. It will be easier when you are gone. Mr. Harlan was silent.
slowly drawing whiffs from his cigar. After a long pause, he said,
"You are prejudiced, and I hope you are mistaken. You only saw the man for a few minutes last night, and you know nothing of him."
"Nothing," answered Santoris, "except what he himself is bound to reveal."
"What do you mean?"
"You will not believe me if I tell you," and Santoris, drawing a chair close to mine, sat down. "Yet I am sure this lady, who is your friend and guest, will corroborate what I say, though, of course, you will not believe her either. In fact, my dear Harlan, you have schooled yourself to believe nothing, so why urge me to point out a truth you decline to accept? Had you lived in the time of Galileo, you would have been one of his persecutors."
"I asked you to explain," said Mr. Harlan, with a touch of pique. "Whether or not I accept your explanations is my own affair."
"Quite," agreed Santoris with a quiet smile. "As I told you long ago at Oxford, a man's entire life is his own affair. He can do with it what he likes, but he can no more command the results of what he does than the sun can conceal its brilliance. Every individual, male and female alike, unconsciously reveals himself as though all his or her faults and virtues were put on separate display by a prism or set out on a windowsill for the inspection of passerby. Fortunately for the general peace, however, most passerby don't look up to see that involuntary display."
"You speak in enigmas," said Harlan impatiently, "and I'm not good at guessing them."
Santoris regarded him fixedly, his eyes luminous and compassionate. "The simplest truths to you are enigmas," he said regretfully. "I'm sorry." He said no more. Mr. Harlan listened with his usual air of cynical rejection and incredulity.
"I have heard this sort of nonsense before," he said. "I have even read in otherwise reliable scientific journals that there are auras about people that can affect one for or against them. But I consider it a merely fanciful suggestion with no foundation in reality."
"Why did you wish me to explain, then?" asked Santoris. "I can only tell you what I know and what I see." Harlan moved restlessly, holding his cigar between his fingers and looking at it curiously, in order, I thought, to avoid the brilliant eyes fixed so compellingly upon him. His wrinkled brow deepened its furrows in a frown.
"Do you mean to tell me, do you dare to tell me," he said, "that you see any aura, as you call it, around my personality?"
"I do, most assuredly," answered Santoris. "I see it as distinctly as I see you in the midst of it. But there is no real light in it. It is merely a gray mist."
"Thank you for the compliment,"
Mr. Harlan laughed harshly.
"Is this a time for compliments?"
asked Santoris with sudden sternness.
"Harlan, would you have me tell you all?"
Harlan's face grew livid. He threw up his hand with a warning gesture.
"No,"
he said, almost violently, clutching the arm of his chair with a nervous grip. For an instant he looked like a hunted criminal, caught red-handed in some criminal act. Recovering himself quickly, he forced a smile.
"What about our little friend's aura?"
he queried, glancing at me.
"Does she express herself through an aura?"
Santoris did not reply for a moment. Then he turned his eyes toward me almost wistfully. "She does," he answered. "I wish you could see her as I do." There was a moment's silence. My face grew warm, and I felt vaguely embarrassed. But I met his gaze fully and frankly. "And I wish I could see myself as you see me," I said half laughingly, "for I am not in the least aware of my own aura." "It is not intended that anyone should be visibly aware of it in his own personality," he answered. "But I think it is right that we should realize the existence of these radiant or cloudy exhalations which we ourselves weave around ourselves, that we may walk in the light as children of the light."
His voice sank to a grave, tender tone, which checked in Mr. Harlan something he had evidently been about to say, for he bit his lip, was silent for a moment, then shifted directions completely.
"I feel so well after those 2 drops of medicine you gave me, Raphael, that I find I simply don't enjoy arguing anymore, at least not for the present."
He reflected for a moment, then said,
"Curious. It has always been my nature to enjoy argument. But I'm feeling too peaceful now to deal with words."
"That is hardly surprising," said Centaurus. "Peace is our natural condition." At this point I rose from my chair and moved away, looking out from the smooth deck of the Dream, shadowed by her full white sails, to the majestic hills surrounding us. A thin, delicate mist draped over the land, like a pale violet veil. Through this mist the sun shot beams of rose and gold, giving an unreal effect to the scenery, as though it glided with us in a cloud pageant over the surface of the calm water. The shores of Loch Scavaig began to appear dimly in the distance, and presently Captain Derrick approached Mr. Harlan, spyglass in hand.
"The Diana must have gone for a cruise," he said in slightly perturbed manner. "As far as I can make out, she isn't where we left her this morning."
Mr. Harlan heard this indifferently.
"Perhaps Catherine wanted a sail," he answered. "There are plenty on board to manage the vessel. You're not anxious."
"Oh, not at all, sir, if you are satisfied," Derrick answered.
Mr. Harlan stretched himself out luxuriously in his chair.
"Personally, I don't mind where the Diana goes for now," he said with a laugh. "I'm particularly comfortable where I am. Santorus," he then called.
"Here I am," said Santorus, who had stepped aside to give some order to one of his men. He approached at the call.
"What do you say to leaving me on board while you and our little friend go by yourselves to see the sunset effect on Loch Korusk?"
Santorus heard this suggestion with an amused look. "You don't care for sunsets?"
"Oh, I do, I suppose, in a way. But I've seen so many."
"The sunsets here are particularly glorious," commented Santorus.
"I dare say. Still, I don't mind missing one. Just now, I should like a good sleep rather than a sunset. It may be unsociable, but..."
Here he half closed his eyes and seemed inclined to doze off then and there. Santorus turned to me. "What do you say? Can you put up with my company for an hour or two, allowing me to be your guide to Loch Korusk?" Our eyes met. A thrill of mingled joy and slight apprehension ran through me. Again, I felt that strange sense of power and dominance which had previously overwhelmed me. "Indeed, I have set my heart on going to Loch Korusk," I replied lightly. "And I cannot let you off your promise to take me there. We will leave Mr. Harlan to his siesta."
"You're sure you do not mind?"
said Harlan. Then opening his eyes, he remarked drowsily,
"You'll be perfectly all right with Santorus."
I smiled. I needed no such assurance. Then I talked gaily with Captain Derrick on the subject of the Diana and the possible course of her present cruise while he scanned the waters in search of her. I watched eagerly our gradual approach to Loch Scavaig, which looked scarcely less dreary in the bright afternoon sun than at night, especially now that the Diana was no longer there to give to the wild and barren surroundings some air of human occupation. The sun was well inclined towards the western horizon when the Dream reached her former moorings and noiselessly dropped anchor. About 20 minutes later, the launch belonging to the vessel was lowered, and I entered it with Santorus. A couple of his men managed the boat as it plowed through the water to the shore.